Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is Parker Bilal, author of the novel White Havens. In White Havens, a hitman for a crime family is sent to kill the family's former accountant, but he changes his mind after getting a call and ends up on the run as they become the targets for the crime family. Set in the United Kingdom, White Havens explores trust and friendship in the crime world. Parker Bilal is the pseudonym of Jamal Majoub, the critically acclaimed literary novelist and author. Born in London to a Sudanese father and English mother, he is also the author of the memoir A Line in the River, which explored his family and life growing up in Sudan. As Parker Bilal, he has written several crime fiction novels, including the Makana series, featuring a Sudanese political refugee working in Cairo as a private investigator. Parker Bilal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So am I correct with this crime thriller, White Havens? Is this your first one-off mystery slash crime thriller, or have you done other one-offs? Because you have the Crane and Drake novels, you have the Makana mystery novels set in Cairo, the Crane and Drake novels set in London. So is this your first standalone thriller?
Yeah, it is actually, and it actually came about in a strange way because I met some people from the Audible company that do audio books, and they asked me if I had any ideas for a one-off book for them. And so originally it was done as an audio book, and then it was later, you know, it was actually re-edited and translated and turned into a printed written book. But it's the first one-off that like really deviates from the series. I mean, the Crane and Drake series takes place mostly in London, but is gradually moving out towards more of a kind of Europe to give it more of a European feel. And I think we get a bit of that in White Havens. But I have a number of ideas for one-offs that are related to the series, but give you that little bit of freedom where you can go off and really explore one of the characters in a little more depth and present it in a kind of a different context. So I thought was interesting about this.
So did you have a different approach knowing that this was a standalone thriller that you decided to take to writing this book compared to the others?
Yeah, I kind of did. I mean, first of all, because it's a one-off, it kind of gives it a certain freedom. And then this story actually began as a short story. So the first chapter was originally a short story that appeared on Audible and a series that they did. And that was kind of the end of the story. It was the story kind of ends. I don't want to give too much away, but the chapter ends quite dramatically. And the story ended in the same way. And then I suddenly thought afterwards, I thought, well, you know what? Actually, maybe there's a way of taking that on and building it into something bigger. So it was really a story that really grew out of that sort of sense of the voice in the beginning and the sort of sense of the atmosphere and the character, and then just letting it kind of go, you know? And let it expand by itself. So it has a kind of, for me, it has a kind of natural feel to it, the way it grew.
So your protagonist Brody is a button man, a hitman, an enforcer working for the apostate. Let me make sure I get the name of the family, the Apostolist Crime Empire.
Yeah.
And this is the first one also where your protagonist is a criminal. So
yeah,
how was that? Was there anything that you thought about in writing a story where the protagonist is actually a criminal?
Well, he's kind of a criminal. I mean, he's obviously a bad guy. But I mean, what I've always been interested in, particularly with this series, is the idea of this kind of area of people moving from one side to the other. So Crane and Brody is actually an old military buddy of Brody. Brody and Drake were in the army together. So Brody actually helped Drake. And when they came back to London and they were both working on opposite sides of the law, they kind of helped each other. So it's kind of that sort of, he's a bad guy, but he's actually, he was a military guy who was actually a good guy. So it's kind of that sort of, it's looking at pushing him sort of from one side to the other.
And in America, we're very familiar with protagonists that are no longer the good guy that wears a white hat, from The Sopranos to Breaking Bad, actually. And what we often find is those protagonists tend to be much more interesting. They tend to be much more complex. And so White Havens is sort of like a road trip crime thriller. And you used a road trip for us to learn Brody's background and also that of the person that he's running with, Karima. Yeah. And so talk a bit about using a road trip to build character, which is how I saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wanted this to be a little bit like those really old, I mean, not really old, I guess they're not that old, but movies from the 60s and the 70s that they used, the gangster movies that they used to make in Britain in the 60s and 70s, where they had things like Get Carter, like the original one, not the one with Sylvester Stallone, and things like the 39 Steps, which is, I think the original version was really back in the 30s or something. But those were all, there was a kind of period where they made, moving around Britain look quite glamorous, but not glamorous, but it gave it a kind of tension. And I wanted to sort of borrow that kind of sense and use that. So a lot of the movement is really also to kind of illustrate the kind of context or the kind of the landscape that they live in. But I've always been interested in the idea of travel and of travel, you know, being exposed to new places, you know, giving you an insight into a character, you know, dealing with when you take somebody out of their home environment, their safe environment, and you move them out into the world, there's a lot that has to happen in order to keep moving. And so that was really part of the attraction. And so it's this idea that I think the road novel or the road movie always does is really sort of place people in uncomfortable situations and let's see how they react to that. And it's through that that we get to know them a little bit better.
But I think what makes your novel different from the road movies is when I think of road movies, you're meeting people you don't know, typically. Right. Well, what we're doing as they try to survive, Karima Coogan, who was an accountant up until 2 years ago for the crime boss, Donnie, we're seeing people from their past and we're learning the background of the characters with the different people they're meeting from their past.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's part of the whole story in the sense that in order to get to the solution, to understand what has happened to them, they have to go into the past and they have to go back. And it's through that seeing people that they know, but again, seeing them in kind of a different light, you know, seeing them in a different situation. So, for example, when they go to Amsterdam at a certain point, then they do see people that they've already known, but they see them again in a different context and in a different light. And that kind of way in which you challenge, even for the characters, you challenge what they think they know with what they discover about those places and those people. I think that's
right.
Part of it.
Right. And for Brody, the former military veteran enforcer for Donnie, he's learning who his friends really are, who his friends really aren't. And for some people, as they would say in the novel, business is just business.
Yeah. For some people, it's just business. I mean, here, the kind of the bad guy behind the whole thing or the person whose shadow who overshadows the whole thing is Donnie Apostolis. He's the guy who's really the puppet master. And he's somebody who has appeared in the Crane and Drake novels. And he's the one who is moving the pieces around the chessboard, as it were, in order to get the kind of result that he wants. And Brody is is somebody who worked for him and is discovering now that working for this guy is not as straightforward as he thought it would be.
Yeah, Donnie's quite a bit of a chess master there. Yeah. and he has such an incredibly long reach, which is, so the tension is with every step of the way, Brody's reaching out, trying to get help, trying to figure out what's going on, and wondering how far is the reach of Donnie? Pretty far, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I you know, Donnie is like a character who really grew out of these. So far, I think I'm working on book number four now. So he's kind of a familiar character, and he evolves over the series, the Crane and Drake series. And there are other guys, other people, I won't say guys, other people coming in, other characters coming in who are kind of challenging his position. So he's, for me, he's like an old familiar character, but he's also one of these characters that you never really completely know. You know, you feel that you know them, even when I'm writing about him. I kind of feel, okay, that's not really what he would go for here. He would do something different, you know. And you discover that as a writer, as you're working with the character sometimes. That if the character has enough depth and enough sort of variety inside them, enough originality, then they keep surprising you. You know, they do come up with things. You know when you write something, you say that that's not done. It's something else. You know, so you're kind of learning about these characters as you go along. And I find that's what, you know, if you write a book, if it's interesting for me, if it's not interesting for me to write the book, if there's no surprises in the process of writing the book, then you know it's not going to be interesting for the reader either. You know, so there has to be something happening in that process of writing the book that surprises me. You know.
So not only are we being surprised about the characters, but the characters are being surprised about each other. So a big theme in this book for me is this whole issue of loyalty and trust.
Yeah.
And especially between Karima, the accountant, is she would you call her a femme fatale, or would you just call her a woman in distress, or some combination of the two?
Yeah, I would say some combination of the two. I mean, she's smart. She's taking care of herself. She thought she was safe, and things turn out differently. But you're right on the money there. That it is really also about them. It's about the trust between them, because obviously at the beginning of the book, without giving too much away, at the beginning of the story, there's not a lot of trust between Brody and Karima. So it's really also about them realizing, that's the journey really, is them, the inner journey, is them realizing that, both of them realizing that in order to get out of this, in order to get through this, they have to learn how to trust each other. And that building of that relationship is really, for me, just the kind of, the calibration of that, just getting it to the, so it's not overdone, but it happens in the right, at the right speed. That was really part of the novel, the story that I really enjoyed doing. You know, it was really the trickiest part.
I know this is probably said often, but we're talking about characters who had damaged characters, meaning they've had experiences that left just really scars that sort of affected the trajectory of how they decided to live their lives, both Karima and Brody. And it's always interesting to see what's going to happen when you get two damaged characters together to see whether or not they'll truly be able to make it together, because they are so distrustful by instinct because of what's happened to them in the past. And in this case, also because of the work they did for Donnie. And as a reader, you're trying to say, will they trust each other? Will they not trust each other? Will more surprises come out of this relationship? And I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, but I think that's actually how that's how we go through life somehow. We are, you know, I mean, these guys, you know, you're learning about yourself through your relationship to other people. And that's what we all do. We learn about ourselves. We're different with different people. You know, we're different with people who've known us, even with people who've known us for a long time. That relationship, those relationships can change in time. And as they change, we become different and the other person somehow becomes different. And that is, I think, one of the key aspects of human relationships. And in this case, it's really about them both recognizing that however they got to this spot where they met, this particular point in space and time, however they got there, if they want to go on, they have to find another way in which to relate to each other, and in how their outlook about themselves and then on the world has to change in order for them to find some way in which they can continue together. So that's kind of key, is this evolution of them together, individually changing or evolving, and also in at the same time together.
When writing this novel, when you first started thinking about the novel, once it went from an Audible short story to an Audible full story, was there any thought in your mind of sort of mapping out a lot of the plot, or you sort of just have a general idea of where you think it wants to go and you let your characters drive the plot themselves?
Yeah, in this one, it was not so much mapped out before. I usually map things out. That's what I do now. The one that I'm preparing now, which will be the Crane and Drake number 4. I really tend to go into quite a meticulous outline of where I want, where the story is going to go, what elements have to happen, and really go into it chapter by chapter. And of course, that once you have a plan, that really is going to change once you go into the actual writing. Things come up, ideas come up, things change, things become, you know, untenable. You realize that's not going to work. You have to find another solution. But it's always a combination of these two things. There are both elements are there. One is the element of the sort of intuition or the improvisation, which is a kind of the creative side, which is always there. And the other side is the logical side, the planning. The logical sort of structuring of things. And you basically always have both elements. You need both elements. And it's always, there's a question of which one takes control at which point, you know. But ultimately, you're playing the two off against each other. You need both. You need to be able to be free to improvise at a certain point, but you also need to have some kind of idea of where it is you're trying to get to, or where it is, how this thing holds together. You know? So often what will happen is that you will start something. In this case, for example, as I said, I really had the idea of the, what felt strong for me was the sense of the characters, the sense of the locations, and I wanted to just maintain that atmosphere all the way through the book. But of course, as you do that, you have to make things, you have to fit things into, make things, they have to make sense. It has to make sense by the end of it. So you keep reassessing where you are and where the plan is and where it's going to go. And at a certain point, it's all, you know, laid out. You know, you can't change anything. You have to go in that direction.
Well, it seemed to me that writing a series that you have to have a lot more structure, because you don't want things happening in book 4 that contradict what happened in book 1 or book 2.
Oh, yeah.
From a planning perspective, whereas with your standalone, you have a lot more freedom, right?
In a way, but also, you know, because Brody and Donnie and a lot of the other people are kind of connected to the Crane and Drake series, you know, there is a kind of, it does tie back, you know, there are things that are happening there that have been mentioned in the Crane and Drake series, you know? And so it has to all fit into that. You can't really start improvising completely freely. So yeah, it's a standalone, and you can, you know, and it works by itself, and it's really like a kind of completely separate thing. But the connection to the Apostolos family is there, and that plays in. You know, I just finished book number 3, the final edits on that. So, and that it's already, there are already elements that are mentioned in Whitehavens that come back in Crane and Drake. So, yeah, it's kind of like everything's tied together. You can't get away from it.
So the potential gang war with the Ziadis, who?
Oh, yeah.
Is that come out of the Crane and Drake books also?
Yes, Yeah, that's the really the big, that's the big setup between the crime gangs that are in the Crane and Drake, and that's comes to a head in book number three and goes on in book number four. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but that's kind of builds up.
Well, you know what you're doing. You're making me want to go back and read all the Crane and Drake novels. Now, I like this because as an avid reader, when you find characters you like, you feel so excited when you find out, oh, there's a lot more books I can read about these characters. So now I have to go back and read Crane and Drake 1, 2, and soon to come out 3.
Well, I mean, I have to keep it in mind when I'm doing the next, whenever I'm going into the next one. And so the Ziad family really, I think we haven't even met the most interesting character in the Ziad family yet. I think that's going to come up in book number four. But it's the thing about a series is there's so many elements that come in, you know, and you want to develop all of them, but there's no, you know, you've also got a story to tell. So there's like, the thing about a series is it's really interesting to be able to allow all these separate pieces to kind of, you know, develop by themselves and then start to sort of connect over time, you know. So all I'm praying for is that I can keep going for a little longer.
So you live in Amsterdam, and Whitehaven's has a scene, part of the book is in Amsterdam. So did you purposely say, I have to include Amsterdam because I want to include the city I live in this book, or was this coming from another place?
Well, partly it's because I always feel that I never write about the places that I actually live in. I'm always writing about places that I did live in at some time and no longer live there. That's part of it. But also part of it is that there is a lot of crime here. There's a lot of organized crime in the Netherlands. There's just, if you've been following the news, a crime journalist was shot in broad daylight a few days ago here. He's part of a very much bigger story about organized crime in this country. And I've always had an interest in that aspect. I was asked at one point to write the biography of a former criminal in this country. And in the end, I declined, perhaps wisely. But I did have some meetings with these people, which was quite interesting. So I felt that there was something there that I wanted to kind of bring in. And so it's very possibly an area that I will go back to at some point.
I would imagine your writing experience is so much different from American writers who haven't had that international experience where you've lived in different countries and you've, you know, been there. You just lived in a lot more countries, a lot more different experience, a lot more exposure to different countries in a significant manner than the typical American writer. Mm. How do you think that affects how you write novels, having lived in so many different places?
Well, I think, you know, my experience is not that uncommon anymore. It was a few years ago, but I think nowadays a lot of people have this experience of, if not themselves, then certainly members of their family who live in other countries and, you know, speak other languages and are exposed to other cultures and so on. I feel that I'm kind of blessed that I've been lucky enough to do this, you know, that I've been lucky enough to be able to travel to these different countries and somehow survive and somehow learn a little bit about the culture and learn a little bit about the language. I think until you learn the language to me is absolutely, you know, essential. Until you learn the other a language, you don't really get into another country or another culture. It has to come through the language. And so I feel like I've been very lucky that I've been able to do that. And I think it kind of gives you a perspective that is really, it's less rooted in the idea that that there is one place that to which I belong and that which I dominate completely and own. You know, when you're traveling, the one thing that you find is that you're always in the minority. You know, you're always the one who doesn't speak the language properly. You're always the one who sort of doesn't really fit into the picture, you know. And so you're constantly in that position of being the outsider as such. And I think in that sense, it gives me a very strong sense that those are the characters I want to write about, you know. Those are the characters, the marginalized characters. Those are the ones that I want to look at and bring into the picture, because I see that all around me, you know, wherever I go. So maybe that's a difference. I don't know. I think for people for people who live in the country that they were born in, maybe even the town that they grew up in, and write about that place, I think there must be a great comfort in that. But I've never had that. I've always been, you know, uneasy, you know, wherever it's going to be. You learn, you get along, you find a way, but you're not completely at ease. You can never say, this is where I grew up, this is where I was, you know. So I'm lucky enough that I have people in other parts of the world that are old friends who know me or have known me for a long time. But it's always at a distance. You know?
So how many languages do you speak?
At the moment, I'm learning Dutch, which is actually quite difficult. And I think after this, I don't think my brain can take anymore. But I can, you know, English and Arabic and French and Spanish and Catalan and Danish. So Dutch is going to be number 7.
Wow. So how many different countries have you lived in, not visited? Because Americans, we visit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we don't live. Yeah. We don't live for a year or 2 years, you know, you know, I have friends where both their daughters went to Italy for, you know, a semester abroad.
Right.
And that's typically the experience, the semester abroad where you live there for 6 months or a year. So how many different countries have you lived in, say, for a year or more?
Oh, well, it's difficult. I mean, obviously, England and Spain and France and Denmark, now the Netherlands, Sudan, Egypt.
Well, that's a lot. You can stop there. Of course, the whole point in this conversation, whereas I've lived in America, but I've lived in New Orleans, I've lived in Houston, I've lived in Dallas.
Yeah. But those are all quite different places. I mean, the experience in those places is completely different. You know, we don't know in Europe or outside the US, we don't really understand, or not everybody understands. We assume America is America, whereas, of course, is a huge differences between one part of the country and another. But I think quite often we don't really get that, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely. So is your primary vocation writing the thrillers and the crime fiction novels sprinkled with some additional essays, nonfiction writing? What's driving your career mostly these days?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I actually kind of more or less gone completely over to writing the crime novels nowadays. The literary fiction that I used to do under my own name is kind of dried up. Not dried up, but it's kind of been put to one side. I became interested in writing nonfiction at a certain point. So I kind of felt that what I would like to really do is write the crime fiction on the one hand, the genre fiction on the one hand, and then nonfiction or creative nonfiction on the other. So I did a book called A Line in the River, which is about my experience.
Right. That's what I interviewed you about. Incredible
exactly.
Book. Loved it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was really like a long-term project. And I want to do a book now, which I'm working on these days, about Spain, about the history of Spain, and about my experience of Spain. But, you know, those projects tend to be a little more abstract and a little bit less focused, so it takes me longer to do them, and it's really not clear where or how they're going to appear or whatever. So they're kind of like going on in the back of my head. The ones that are really focused are the crime novels. You know, those are the ones that keep me, you know, in shelter and food
and silks and jewels.
Yeah, exactly, silk and jewels. Yeah, yeah. That would be nice. Well, I mean, I'm not really, but, you know, keep me alive, but keep the wolf from the door, as they used to say. So and also it's kind of a compulsion. Once you start writing crime novels, you know, there's a, you know, there's one story leads to another. So, you know, in this series, once you've done one, there's another one to come up. And right now I'm working on Crane and Drake number 4, but actually I have maybe 3 ideas for standalone books that I would also like to do, you know, connected to that series. So it's a kind of, I just need more time. You know, I need to be faster at this, you know.
So how many hours a day do you write?
I tend to sort of start in the morning and go on until the evening. I mean, I'll go on unless something comes in to disturb me, I'll just be writing all day. So I have to find excuses to go out, you know, whether I have to go, you know, out for a run or go to the gym or whatever. It's good to have something to do. But otherwise, I think, you know, I would just keep going.
How is the life as a writer from the outside? As a non-writer, we all look at that as a solitary existence. Well, tell me we're wrong.
It's kind of scary in the sense that, you know, it's quite uncertain. And I think it's we don't know. You don't know if your books are going to sell or if you're going to get another book contract or what's going to happen. I have 2 ongoing, you know, TV adaptations that seem to be taking forever. But, you know, what can I do about that? That would be great if it actually comes together. But I'm waiting. I'm stuck waiting for other people to do that. So there's like everything is kind of like a little more uncertain than if you had a regular job. But to be honest with you, it seems to me that like a lot of what we used to call regular jobs are no longer as certain as they used to be, you know. So I guess, and I don't have any reason to complain. I mean, so far, touch wood, things are going. So I guess all I can say. I mean, I think it demands a lot of personal dedication. I mean, it's a compulsion. It's really like a writing has got to be something. Nobody's there to get you up in the morning. Nobody's going to write it for you, you know? And if you don't sit down and actually make the effort to put the words one after the other and turn them into pages and turn them into chapters and whatever, nobody's going to make you do that, you know? So it has to come from that sort of urge from within. And I can't tell you where that comes from. I really can't. I don't know where it comes from. But it is an impulse to tell a story. That's something that I think I've had since I was a child. And I think I inherited that from my father. My father could tell stories, you know. He couldn't write them down, but he could tell them. And I think that that's some part of that sort of basic human ability to tell stories is where it comes from, you know.
Well, when I interviewed you about your memoir, and that was my first introduction to you, knew nothing about the Parker Bilal books. The first word that came to mind was literary. And So I looked at you sort of in a whole different light based on being introduced to you, not by your genre fiction, but by the memoir. And I wonder how the people that know you from the genre fiction look at the memoir.
I'm not sure that the crossover works that way. I think people who are interested in the genre fiction are interested in the genre fiction. They're not necessarily interested in going somewhere else. I think people who are interested in literary fiction or in literary nonfiction, things like the memoir, like A Line in the River, I don't think that most of them, I'm generalizing, but I don't think that most of them are interested in genre fiction. You know,
I'm an outlier.
Yeah, you would be an outlier. And in that sense, I'm also an outlier in that, you know, it's unusual to be interested in doing both of them to such an extent, I think. But I think that a lot of the people that I know who consider themselves to be literary writers would really not say, I read crime fiction as well, or I read genre fiction. And a lot of the people who read crime fiction I'm not really interested in going the other way either. So it's kind of strange that the two things are so separate in people's minds, but readers kind of seem to me to break down along those, you know, into those groups.
Well, a couple of my favorite crime fiction writers actually have PhDs in English, James Lee Burke,
right.
Megan Abbott has a PhD right. in English. There's another writer, I think John McDonald, Ross McDonald had a PhD in English.
Right.
And so I was actually surprised.
Those are all writers that I like, you see. Those are all, those writers who I mean, James Lee Burke is an absolute, you know, I absolutely love his writing. And he has a very strong, there's a very strong literary sense in his writing. You know, you can feel that. The language and a strong poetic sense, but you know, I think that's unusual in terms of crime fiction. You know, those people are really even Ross McDonald. I mean, Ross McDonald also was has a literary sort of aspect to his writing, which I think the average crime writer would be happy to admit they don't have. You know. I'm certainly leaning more towards that kind of literary crime fiction area.
Well, I'll tell you what Jim told me, James Lee Burke, and I feel strange actually calling him Jim. He tells me to call him Jim, though he's old enough to be my father.
Right.
Incredibly nice human being. I've interviewed him 6 or 7 times. Just incredibly nice. And he told me he started writing crime fiction because he couldn't sell his literary fiction.
Right.
And someone recommended to him to try the crime fiction out, and he tried it. And the Dave Robichaud novels ended up taking off. So I've always loved his crime fiction is so effusive and visceral, and just the descriptions, and my degree is in accounting, so I can't get into all the fancy English language, but just his, it's so different from a lot of crime fiction writers.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's the case with a lot of writers. I mean, people who wanted to write literary fiction, but couldn't somehow make a go of it. And then they fell into crime fiction, but actually the crime fiction that they write is very distinguished crime fiction. I mean, another one I think would be the Swedish Henning Mankell, who died, I think he died a few years ago. But again, he had a kind of longing to write literary fiction and wound up in writing crime fiction. And I mean, you know, what can you say? I mean, as long as they, you know, it's good that we have people like James Lee Burke writing these books. You know, I think he's also an example of somebody who really, it's really the long game he's playing. You know, I mean, those books really tell a long story about in the life of this character, Dave Robichaud. I mean, it's really, it's not sort of, he's not just cutting you into a corner of this. This is like the whole extent of this guy's existence, which comes through it. And I think that is the kind of literary project that is a lifetime's work, you know, by the end of it.
So before you wrote your memoir, most people looked at you as a crime fiction writer, right?
No. I mean, I had a long period of being a literary writer. I was writing literary fiction.
Okay.
I published 6 or 7 novels, which are, I think, all of them out of print. So I did manage to get them published, but they weren't going anywhere. And the problem I felt was, again, partly related to what we were talking about, that I don't, for reviewers and critics and so forth, and audiences, it's very difficult for them to figure out where do they place me, you know? Am I one of them? Am I, you know, there's quite a strong national sense in looking at literary fiction of belonging to a particular tradition. And I think that for me, the difficulty was that nobody really seemed to feel that I fitted into one of their traditions. I think nowadays, maybe it would be easier. Nowadays, there are more voices coming out from that kind of place that I came from, you know, between countries, between worlds, between cultures, whatever you want to call it. But there's more of that today. There are a lot of young writers today who are doing that. And so, and I think therefore the world is kind of, the critical world is much more open to that. And so people are more receptive. When I was doing it, it really wasn't. So I kind of, you know, I wouldn't say that I was completely frustrated, but I could see that the time that it took for a novel to be published, to be written, and to be accepted and to be published, there was no way I could survive on that, you know? And at the same time, I wanted, not just for financial reasons, but for my own, you know, the reasons of my soul or whatever, I needed to get books out. You know, I needed to get books, to see my books in print. And the only way I could do that is if I did what I had wanted to do for a long time, which was to start writing crime fiction. So it was really, when I started doing the McKenna series, it was really the fulfillment of a long-standing ambition, you know.
Were there any particular crime fiction series prior to starting writing in that genre that you just found incredibly, that you loved?
Well, I mean, as I've mentioned, James Lee Burke and Ross McDonald, the Lou Archer stories, and people like is it Martin Cruz Smith?
The one set in Russia. Yes.
Yeah.
Love those. Oh, you know, he had one came out. Was it last year? I found the last one. The last one came out, I think, last year.
Okay.
Yeah, he had one more that came out because I don't remember how I ran into Gorky Park, but I'm a huge fan of the Martin Cruz Smith novel.
Yeah, set in Russia. There's like four or five of them that I know of. I think I lost track of it after a while, but the first four or five of them, those really impressed me. And so that was the kind of thing that I was looking at. I was really looking at and again, there is a literary style to the guy's writing, you know? So I kind of felt that was really the sort of direction that I wanted to go in.
Parker Bilal, what's your website?
My website is www.parkerbilal.com, I think.
Perfect. Parker Bilal, author of the thriller White Havens, also coming out, Crane and Drake novels. You also do the McKenna mysteries, but I guess Crane and Drake novels is the series you're focusing on these days, right?
Well, McKenna is not finished, but I still have four novels that I want to do in the McKenna series. But those four are going to go up to the Arab Spring of 2011, and they have to be quite tightly tied together. So as soon as I can take a break from Crane and Drake, I'll do those.
And just as a reminder to the audience, the McKenna novels are generally set in Cairo.
Yes, they are.
Egypt.
They're set in Cairo in the decade leading up to the Arab Spring. So each book covers a year leading up to 2011. Which was quite an extraordinary decade. I mean, that was the impulse for that series. Was, you know, you had 9/11, you had the invasion of Iraq, you had everything that was going on in the neighborhood in the Middle East, some quite extraordinary stuff. And I thought all of this is somehow building up to something, which was the Arab Spring.
Well, Parker Bilal, thank you so much for being a guest.
It's a great pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, your host and producer.